From KCUR Studios, this is Statehouse Blend, Kansas. Today from the first floor of the Kansas State House, as lawmakers return to Topeka for what will be a grueling veto session with nothing but big things to solve before going home. Well, we don't know when. We'll talk education funding in a little bit, but first we're going to tackle the budget and taxes needed to fund it. And we'll start our discussion with two leaders of the House who will introduce themselves now.
My name is Jim Ward. I am the minority leader of the Kansas House from Wichita.
And I'm Don Heineman, the majority leader in the Kansas House from Dighton.
Joining Representatives Heineman and Ward is my Kansas News Service colleague, Jim McLean, as he always does for our live events. Jim, happy to have you.
Hey, thanks, Sam.
Before we jump in, I'm going to start a little contest on who can predict when this session will end. The winner gets an extra Statehouse Blend mug and whatever else I can rustle up out of the closet. Jim Ward, I'll start with you. Date that we're done.
June 15th.
June 15th. Wow. Representative Heineman.
It would be a great birthday present to me if we could finish things up on my birthday, May 27th.
Let's jump right in, and I want to start with you, Jim. Your first question for the leaders.
As you guys start this veto session, the first thing you're going to be looking at is the revenue situation. How much you need to raise in additional revenue, i.e. tax increases. So, Jim, we're up to 450 now, so what do you have to say about that?
Well, I'm going to reject the frame, because you can't really raise revenue until you deal with the number one priority of Kansas State government, which is K-12. We need to know what we need to spend in K-12 before we can determine how much we raise in revenue. Otherwise, we're going to continue to come back over and over again. And I don't like raising taxes. My people don't like me doing it. I can only make it work if I connect it to a real result in their lives, which is good K-12.
While we're talking about raising revenue, let's move on to whether or not you think we'll see an increase in the gasoline tax. Representative Heineman, I'll start with you.
Currently, there's not a great deal of discussion about increasing the motor fuels tax, but there's a large recognition that we are not doing right by KDOT anymore. So we need to address that somehow, and the two options are either raise the motor fuels tax or allow additional bonding for KDOT, taking on more debt for future years. Neither of those is very palatable, but leaving KDOT without funds to operate is not acceptable either.
If neither are very palatable, before I get Jim's reaction here, which one is more palatable to you? Representative Heineman. Bonding or taxes?
You know, at this point, I'm not willing to land on either option. I'm still weighing the pros and cons.
Your option?
Here's the fundamental problem, is CAPERS, highway plan, this destruction of our mental health system, Osawatomie, these are all products of a failed tax experiment that we have to address. And until we address that, we can't continue. And so either option is bad. They're more palatable if we have a pathway out of them. The continuing short-term, let's just get by this budget cycle or this revenue estimate cycle, that's what I reject. And so I reject trying to put together a plan that takes care of somebody just for a year. We have to have a long-term plan to get out of this tax experiment that has failed so badly. And then we can start doing short-term things to get us through until the system settles down once we have the revenue plan
just in place. Just to be clear, for the sake of the listeners, when you're talking about a motor fuels tax increase or even the bonding proposal, what you're talking about, everybody knows that, you know, several projects across the state, modernization projects and so forth, have literally been postponed / canceled. What you're talking about is providing KDOT with some bridge funding simply to do basic maintenance on the state highways, because all the budget plans that I've seen so far would take about $580 million over the next two fiscal years in money that otherwise would go to KDOT, correct?
That's correct, absolutely. And, you know, I relate it to my own farm. If I don't keep up the maintenance on my combine, on my tractor, and try to put it off till next year and then the year after that, pretty soon I have a big repair bill, bigger than I ever would have had if I'd kept up maintenance on an annual basis. And that's the situation at KDOT right now. They don't have the operational funds to keep up with preservation and maintenance projects. That will cost us big money in the future if we don't keep up.
What are the chances? I mean, in recent years, toward the end of the session, when you're negotiating revenue packages, there's always the issue of other kinds of issues that creep in. Like, for instance, as we raise taxes, are we going to lower taxes on food and groceries because we have among the highest in the country? Given the revenue situation, is it even plausible in your minds to start talking about some of that? Is that still a leverage point as you head into the final weeks?
I think there's broad recognition that we need to address that issue, that we are too high on sales tax on food, and at some point we need to do something about it. But in the current fiscal situation, it just doesn't seem realistic in the short run. But it's definitely something that should become a priority as we do right the fiscal ship in future years.
Jim, that's been a big issue with Democrats in recent years. One proposal would have taken it from 6.5 to 2.6, costing about $66 million a year for every point you lower it. Is that doable?
This year it's not. It's the right thing to do. It's morally wrong that we charge people as high as we do for food. But I do agree, and I continue to push, that we have to erase the tax experiment that has put us in this constant fiscal crisis where we choose against poor children or mentally ill, before highways or schools. We have to determine what the essential core services are, and I think we have, by the budget process, determined those core services. We have to step up and put the funding mechanism year in and year out, and then as we stabilize, we can go back and replenish KDOT, replenish, you know, our CAPER system, and start a long-term gradual reduction of food sales tax. But we can't do anything under this constant fiscal crisis where we're always below projections on revenue. We're always pitting one group against the other as somehow poor children are the reason elderly aren't getting nursing homes.
So isn't the really big question as you head into this session is to what extent are you going to roll back Governor Brownback's signature tax cuts from 2012? I mean, how far will you go in that direction? Will you add the bracket back on? Is there any chance you take them all the way back to 2012 levels? I mean, I'd like to hear both of you on that.
Well, we put 85 votes up in the House for a package that essentially repealed it and put together a solid revenue stream for the next 3 to 4 years. I mean, there was 24 votes in the Senate. I think the people of Kansas have already moved by, and the legislature, the person on the second floor is the one that's obstructing, and that's where we're at right now, an obstructionist governor.
I would say that full repeal is not possible at the current time. And I'm not sure full repeal is absolutely necessary. I believe we can fund state government responsibly with some number less than full repeal would give us.
But income taxes, that's the big play, right, as we head forward? Doing something there?
Yeah, that's where the leverage is currently. I mean, property tax increases are always very unpopular, both in urban and rural Kansas. There's widespread agreement that we've pretty much maxed out on sales tax. We can't go any higher there. Really ought to look at reducing it, at least on food, when we can. So that leaves income tax as the other potential revenue source, and that's why the focus is on income tax right now.
There's just still some... Go ahead.
One thing I want to remind you, the bill we passed out with 85 votes on the override and 24 in the Senate repealed the LLC exception that allowed 330,000 or more Kansans to use services and not pay income tax. It eliminated that whole idea that we would not have income tax in Kansas at all at some point in time. It restructured our income taxes to three brackets so that we would ask those who benefit the most from our community, the highest 1%, to pay a share in the common good. I think that structure is fundamentally sound and gets us to the next stage. Now, what the numbers are in each one of those brackets, we should have that conversation and continue to move forward. But the structure of idea of getting rid of the LLC, removing the glide path to zero, and the three, the most wealthy, the middle class, and the lower middle class, all contributing something through middle class, like, is the best structure.
There's still some talk about, there's still some fat perhaps in the budget, places to cut in the next couple of years. I want to go with Representative Heineman and ask, do you think that there's still places to cut in the budget to balance it in the coming two fiscal years?
There probably are, but they are very, very limited in number and magnitude. Think about this, that Governor Brownback has been governor for almost 7 years now. And no one has ever accused Governor Brownback of being a tax and spend liberal. He and his staff have been looking for places to cut the budget ever since he was first inaugurated. And during that same period of time, the appropriations process has been under the control of very strong fiscal hawks. They also have been looking for places to cut. And if they couldn't find them in the last 6 or 7 years, then I'm pretty well satisfied that they either don't exist or they are very, very well hidden. We will continue looking for those options and look for places where we can responsibly reduce expenditures without harming delivery of governmental services. But I don't think there's a lot of productive opportunity in that, going down that road.
Representative Ward.
We don't call Brownback tax and spend, we call him borrow and spend. He's raised the state debt significantly in his 7 years and spent a lot of money. Also, that question assumes that we haven't made cuts. I think we've gone through 9 cycles of cuts over the past years, and we've seen the devastation to state programs. Are there places that we could squeeze a few bucks? Certainly, but to suggest that there is cuts in our budget that will fund our schools and solve our fiscal crisis is delusional at best.
I'm going to give Jim the last question here in just a moment, but I do want to touch on a subject that I follow quite closely, that is guns. Just last week, we heard that state hospitals would need $24 million to hire armed guards to keep weapons out of Osawatomie and out of Larned. KU Med Center says that they're going to need upwards of $30 million to hire armed personnel to do that. I'm going to start with you, Representative Heineman, and ask where you are. Is this a good allocation of resources, or should you be talking about rolling back concealed and carry on both college campuses and at hospitals?
Well, it certainly illustrates the magnitude of the problem that that's what it would cost to protect or to secure the state facilities. $24 million, 180 FTEs. That's fantastic that it would cost that much. And I believe the numbers are accurate, so that's a choice. Do we spend that money to secure the facilities in that way, or do we truly allow concealed carry in hospitals and facilities where emotions typically run high, very high tension situations occur quite often, and that's a choice that the legislature is going to have to wrestle with.
Representative Ward.
I sit here as a person who grew up in Kansas and respects the gun culture of hunting, collecting, personal safety. I voted for carry and conceal with training and background checks. I voted for a Castle Doctrine, so I believe in guns. But I also believe in gun safety, and there are places that guns just don't belong. Hospitals, schools, churches, and we should have a vote on whether or not the people of Kansas, through their representatives, want guns in these highly unique places. And I have to reject one of my ultra conservatives who says, well, there are guns on college campuses, and so therefore we shouldn't have any restrictions. And I'm thinking, well, that would be an argument for no speed limit because there are speeders. No, we set the cultural norm that guns don't belong on college campuses or in state hospitals. And then we empower those institutions to take whatever actions necessary to carry that out. Will we be 100% perfect? No, but we will be safer with guns off of college campuses, not in state hospitals, not in mental institutions, or not in nursing homes.
We're going to move on to a deeper discussion with our Senate panel here in a couple of minutes about education. But Jim McLean, wrap this panel up for us.
I want to, since you, Sam, covers guns and this issue of concealed carry, so he asked that question. I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask my standard question about Medicaid expansion as we head into the final weeks. I know that folks have, the coalition that's pushing for expansion has done a lot over the break to lobby members to get those final votes they need for a veto-proof majority. Is there going to be another vote on expansion in the final weeks of the session? And then, Sam, I ask your permission to have one final question of Jim Ward when they answer that question. Don?
I'm not sure that we will address it again this session. The conversation is not over. There will be another initiative to expand Medicaid, but my best guess is that happens next year, not this session.
Jim?
Yes, We will. There are at least five hospitals ready to close in our state within the next 60 days. We've had one close in Independence. We've got one on critical in Topeka that has announced it was closing, and then some activity has gone on. You can go to Fort Scott, you can go to Wellington, you can go to any number of communities and see the massive devastation of the refusal to take common sense steps to protect our healthcare system. So whatever technique or tactic I need to use, we are going to do everything in our power to get another vote on Medicaid expansion.
So Sam, this is what I wanted to ask Jim, since he's a regular guest on State House Blend and has had his share of the donuts. I thought that this might be an occasion where you might want to say whether you're running for governor or not.
Not today.
Anybody in here running for governor today? All right, good. House Majority Leader Don Heineman, House Minority Leader Jim Ward. Now, don't go away. We're going to trade out this pair for two other legislators to talk about education. I see Senator Molly Baumgardner is here and Senator Anthony Hensley. So can you help? Okay, here we go. The other giant issue facing lawmakers is school funding. In some ways, when hasn't it been a giant issue? And this is vastly more complicated because there's another player in all of this, the state Supreme Court. We have two legislators now, both educators, by the way, to help show us the way, and they will introduce themselves now.
I'm Senator Anthony Hensley, and outside of being in the legislature, I'm a classroom teacher.
I'm Senator Molly Baumgardner. I represent the 37th District, which is Southern Johnson County and Northern Miami County. I was in the classroom at the high school level, and now I'm in the classroom at the community college level.
All right, I'm going to get you both in the pool now for an extra State House Blend mug and whatever else I can rustle up. I need an estimate, a date certain about when we're going to be done with this legislative session. Senator Hensley, I'll start with you.
My guess is, I don't know if I can give you a date certain, but my guess is we're going to be here at least for 2 weeks and possibly a third.
I'm going to need a date if you want to be in the pool. If you don't want to be in the pool, that's okay.
Well, it'd be, assuming it'd be a week after Mother's Day, it would be May 21st.
Senator Baumgardner?
I'll go May 18th.
Jim McLean stays with me for the panel, and with your kind permission, I'll take the first question here. And I want to hear from both of you how this is going to work. There's been a lot of work done on school finance in the House, not nearly as much in the Senate. Senator Hensley, I'll start with you. How is this all going to come together to get a school funding formula that will pass the legislature and pass muster with the state Supreme Court?
Well, Sam, from a historical perspective, I actually asked the Legislative Coordinating Council to form a school finance interim study 2 years ago, back in July of 2015. And unfortunately, they turned me down at that time because I felt like we needed that extra time in order to develop a new formula. The block grant system, which I voted against, was declared unconstitutional since then. And now we're under the gun, quite frankly. And just today on the floor of the Senate, I passed out a timeline that showed how much further behind we are this year than we were last year in terms of dealing with the equity part of the Gannon decision. This time we're dealing with the adequacy part of the Gannon decision. And I agree that the House is light years ahead of the Senate when it comes to this plan. They do have a proposal that would appropriate $150 million over the next 5 years. And obviously the starting point with all of this is to basically go back to the original formula. The original formula, which I voted for when I was in the House in 1992, that was about 40 pounds ago for me. In 1992, we passed a good fundamental school finance formula, and we should have kept it into place as opposed to repealing it. Unfortunately, over time, the legislature has underfunded that formula to some rather large proportions. And so we've got until June 30 to get it right. The House has given us a good starting place, and I'm hoping that they'll pass a bill that the Senate then can consider.
Pass it this week, you hope?
Well, within the next couple of weeks for certain, yeah.
Senator Baumgardner, how's this all going to get done? There's a lot of work to be done.
You know, I think quite frankly, when we look at the work that's been done by the House, they have the advantage of having two separate committees. They have the Education Finance Committee as well as the larger Education Committee. But I think that there are particularly some issues that on the Senate side we've certainly been paying attention to. And that is, how is it that we identify that a student is at risk? Because quite frankly, to have that be dependent on whether or not a parent or guardian filled out the forms, the federal forms, for them to be eligible for free and reduced lunch has nothing to do with whether or not they are academically at risk. And so one of our concerns is that we can have folks, students, that are kind of falling through the cracks as far as not being identified and not receiving, that funding is not tethered to them. So even if a parent or guardian filled out that paperwork and they were eligible for or identified as being an at-risk child, that funding that went to the school district wasn't tethered to that child or any type of additional services that they would receive. And so I do think in talking to fellow senators and House members, there is very much a concern that we focus on all kids and where they are academically and make sure that they are not progressing from an elementary school to a middle school to a high school without having that solid foundation in reading, in writing, and in mathematics. So, you know, I was heartened by the Supreme Court's focus on that outcome of one out of four Kansan kids didn't have that academic achievement level that we know is important. There is a reason that we have one community college where 88% of their incoming students that had just in May graduated from high school, and in August they're enrolled in the community college, 88% of them are needing to take remedial courses. So we know that there is very much a need for kids to have those additional services so that academically they are ready to achieve if they join the military or if they decide to go into a vocational certificate training program or go to the community college or to a university. And so I think that we will, on the Senate side, there's going to be a lot of focus on making sure that funding is actually tagged to the kid with the particular need that they have. That's true for ELL, it's true for special needs kids that have an IEP, and so it needs to be true for kids that are academically at risk. So I think that's going to be our focus.
Well, Jim McLean?
Well, just listening to both their answers, I think it should be apparent from the get-go, the complexity of this issue and the depth to which you can go in exploring the issue. But I want to go back to a process question just for practical reasons. It seems we have a bit of a cart and horse situation here regarding the need for additional revenue to balance the state budget and do other things, and then whatever revenue we need to finance a new school finance formula. Before you can get to some of those other more substantive policy issues, it seems like there's already a debate in the legislature as to which should come first, whether you should holistically approach the revenue situation, including the school finance, or take them separately. So I'd be interested to start with you, Senator Baumgartner, as to how you feel we should proceed on that.
Well, I do feel that the funding formula is very important for us to identify where it is over the course of the next 3 to 5 years we are going to truly ramp up and increase the funding in education where it is needed.
But if you're going to pass a tax bill, do you think you should anticipate how much you need for education and the budget at the same time?
Absolutely. I mean, when we look at how we address things in our personal lives, we have an idea of how much something's going to cost before we go out and make that purchase or make that commitment for it. So for me, I am a conservative mom, and a conservative mom is going to say, we need to decide what is the best plan for, and I'm not going to say K through 12 because it is pre-K through 12. We need to find out what is the best plan for funding education.
Right.
We need to know what that price tag is, and that is how you don't get into the situation that we have been in before where we don't have adequate funding for schools. The worst thing we could do is to tell the nearly 300 school districts in our state that this is what your funding's gonna be, and next year not have the funding for it. School districts throughout the state are already working on their budgets. They've already done interviewing. They're already hiring folks as faculty members and support staff. And so for us to not acknowledge that they are in that process right now, and they need an assurance that if this is what the formula is, the state's going to come through on that fund.
I need to get Senator Hensley in on this. Where are you on this?
Oh, he agrees with me on this.
Jim, I think it's time that we put together a tax package that takes into account not only the self-inflicted budget crisis that has come as a result of the 2012 income tax cuts, but also takes into account what we've got to do for school finance and what we've got to do to comply with the court order in the Gannon case. And if the $150 million is the figure, as the House has proposed to do, then I think we need to plug in $150 million to make sure that we raise the amount of revenue necessary to stabilize and balance our budget and at the same time comply with the court order. The other thing that I would disagree with Senator Bumgarner about is poverty. There is a strong correlation between poverty and student achievement. And I think what the House has decided to do is stay with that definition of at risk to include free lunch. That is as good an indicator as you can have within your school finance formula to say that we know that people, children who live in poor homes have difficulty in achieving success in school, and I think we ought to stick with that as the qualifier for at risk.
Very quickly, Senator.
Very briefly. You know what? I think the good senator and I do not disagree. He is saying that I was taking the position that there's not a correlation. One, I understand there is a correlation. But two, I do not want any child in our state to not receive the services that they need if they have a parent or guardian for whatever reason that didn't fill out the paperwork. And what about the kid that's not eligible for free and reduced but still is academically at risk? A kid that's academically at risk, I don't care what the home circumstances are, I don't care if their parents filled out a form or not, I want them to receive the services that they need while they're in school.
I want to move on. In the House bill, there's a provision to expand tax credits to pay for schooling in private school, religious schools. So far, the state hasn't spent a lot of money on that, but there is a plan to expand that along with some accountability for the schools that wasn't in the previous legislation. I want to hear where you both are on that, and Senator Hensley, I'm going to start with you.
Well, I've opposed the tax credits for school choice, I guess you might call it, because I think we have a more difficult time enough to adequately fund public schools. And so when that particular proposal became part of the block grant system, that was just yet another reason why I voted against the block grant system.
Senator Baumgartner?
I know that we have that system in place. It's not used much. Over the course of the 3 years, I think that it's been in place, it's totaled to a tax credit of $1.1 million. So that's $1.1 million that haven't come in. To me, I think it's important that if a child is in a school district, perhaps where they're not receiving the services that they need, that they have another option. It's my understanding that there have been several different amendments as far as that school choice on the House side that have all fallen to defeat. So I don't see at this point any expansion. I don't think that there's an interest for expanding it at this time. And I think if you just have a discussion of what's in place at this point, it's very underutilized.
One quick follow-up for you, Senator Hensley. Yeah. If that was part of the package that was needed to move it through the Senate so you could get the amount of money you think needs to be in there, could you live with that tax credit?
Sam, I never draw a line in the sand. And if that was part of it, It was part of a much larger school finance plan that complied with the Gannon court order. Then I'd just have to take it into consideration. Yep.
I want to wrap this part of the podcast up with a bigger picture question. I want to start with you, Senator Baumgartner. When you're in your Republican caucus, are there some core education issues that you talk about that need to be in this, whatever this new funding plan is, something that is forward-looking? What are those core principles, Senator? And I want to give Senator Hensley, I'll give him that question as well. But I'll start with you, ma'am.
Well, I think one of the things that we've done is we've focused, in prior years, there's been a lot of focus on that student from K through 12, and when they're done with 12, they are going to jump into a college setting. And I think that one of the things that we're going to start to see is those last 4 years of high school, we're going to start to see some blurring of the lines, and we're going to see more interaction with colleges and universities. You're going to have students have an opportunity, more students have an opportunity to, at the time that they're graduating from high school, they'll also be graduating or earning a certificate from a technical institution or from a community college. And I think you're going to continue to see, particularly with that individual study plan that's going to be incorporated at the middle school level. You know, the Board of Education is wanting kids to know and start thinking about what it is that they want to do when they're out of school. And so I think that when that begins to be implemented at the middle school, you're going to have a whole lot more focus on what are the different steps or different options as you're in high school and once you leave. And so I think making sure kids are ready for that next step, and it's very focused and very intentional, I think that that's going to be where we're going to see a change.
Senator Hensley, you teach in high school. What are those Democratic core principles that need to be thought of as we move forward?
Well, when I, in the role that I'm in, when I go out and actually try to convince people to run for the Senate as a Democrat, I always tell folks that if there's a litmus test for any candidate that I'm going to try to recruit or any of our incumbents who are running for re-election, the litmus test is their support for K-12 education. Beyond that, whether it's social issues or whatever other issues, they're pretty much on their own in terms of representing their district. But to a person in our caucus, we emphatically support K-12 education. We've always done that, and I think we'll always continue to do so. And I think one of the core values that our caucus will bring to this debate when we talk about school finance is to make sure that we take into account the disparity in wealth among school districts. We have to take care of the students who go to the Galena schools, as well as taking care of the students who go to the Burlington schools. And believe you me, there is such a huge disparity in wealth between those two school districts. $1 million in Galena raises about $32,000, which is $34 per student, whereas $1 million in Burlington raises $450,000, which equates to $550 per student. So whatever new formula we have, we can't leave the students of Galena behind. We've got to make sure that everybody has an equal opportunity, and that's what the Gannon case is all about in terms of not only equitably funding schools, but adequately funding schools as well.
And that's where we, well, Senator Baumgartner, I'll give you a chance to respond here.
I appreciate quickly. That. Well, my mother-in-law graduated from Galena High School, so I think that really kind of draws this line that it's not just if you're a Democrat that you care about all kids in our schools in Kansas. All Kansans should be caring about what is best for our kids in Kansas schools. And I think that I am hearing so much support for education from Republican side, And I think that we collectively, the Republicans and the Democrats, are going to work together to make sure we have a funding formula that is best, regardless of what part of the state you come from, is going to be best for the kids.
Senator Molly Baumgartner from Lewisburg, Senator Anthony Hensley from Topeka, this would be appropriate time to thank them.
Thank you.
And thanks to my Candace News Service colleague, Jim McLean. I am always smarter when I leave this podcast and you're here.
What do you say to that?
And that's State House Blend Candace, live event from the State House in Topeka.